Welcome to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Sunday, May 28th, 2023. Of course, my website is therealistreport.com, where you will find an extensive archive of these podcasts, as well as other programs I participate in. You will also find all of my blog posts and articles, my Twitter feed, which is embedded in the right-hand sidebar of the website, a contact page, and many other useful and important links. I am on Twitter and Gab at @realistreport. And you can find me on Telegram at t.me/TheRealistReport. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to and help edit The Barnes Review, a bi-monthly revisionist history magazine. Please do subscribe to these fine print publications if you do not already. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for all the details. All right, today I am joined by John Massaro once again. John is the author of Will Vaccines Be the End of Us? All right, John Massaro, welcome back to the program, sir. How are you today?
I'm doing fine, John. Thanks for having me back on.
Yeah, thanks for joining me once again. You are, of course, the author of Will Vaccines Be the End of Us, which is a must-read book for anyone out there who has not picked up a copy yet. Your website is endtheshots.com, which I will have a link to when I post this podcast program. And I will also have a link to purchase your book directly from your website, or it's actually available also from the American Free Press bookstore. If anyone is interested in picking up a copy, I'll have links to both of those places where you can get a copy. Now, we've done numerous programs. I think this is the 7th interview. So I'm sure most listeners are familiar with you and your work. And today we're gonna kind of pick up on our travel stories and talk about some travel experiences in Europe. And mine is quite limited compared to you, as are all my travel experiences. It seems like you've really traveled a lot. And, you know, I hope at one point I can catch up with you. Although I don't know if that's going to be possible the way I'm going, because you've really traveled a lot. And just briefly, I'll just say I only went to Europe once, and it was in 2006. I did a study abroad program. It was a little bit over two weeks. I think it was like 16 or 17 days. It was a 16 or 17 day program in a little small, like, medieval town called Ripetransone, which is on the, it's kind of like the, well, it's definitely the east coast of Italy, but it's kind of like central northeast, I guess. And it was pretty much right on the coast, or a small little, you know, sort of medieval town. And there really weren't a lot of tourists or anything. It was kind of, I got the impression it was kind of like an area where wealthy Italians had, like, vacation homes. And it was a really, really cool experience, a really cool place. So I did the 2 week program there. I flew in for, I was going to school at the University of Nebraska, and I flew from Nebraska to Amsterdam. That was like the main, you know, hub to get to Europe, the cheapest way to get to Europe from, well, at least from Nebraska. So I flew into Amsterdam. I stayed like 3 or 4 days in Amsterdam, and then I bought a Euro Rail pass, so I could, you know, I had like 6 or 7 or maybe even more, I can't remember. I had so many trips that I could do and go like anywhere basically. So I bought that so that way I could kind of travel all throughout Europe and get to where I needed to go in Italy. And so I flew into Amsterdam, stayed there for a few days, and then I took a train from Amsterdam to Paris. I was only in Paris for like a little over 24 hours, so it was a really quick trip. I didn't really get to do a whole lot. I did kind of walk around, and, you know, I saw the Eiffel Tower and walked around like the Notre Dame Cathedral and that sort of thing. But I mean, Paris is obviously like a huge city, so there was a lot I really didn't get to do and see. And then I went from Paris to Italy, and I basically went pretty much straight to the study abroad program that I did. And then after that was over with, I took a train from this little medieval town directly to Rome, and I stayed in Rome for like 4 nights. And then I went from Rome to Vienna, Austria, stayed there for like 3 or 4 nights. And then from Vienna, I went to Munich, stayed there again for like 3 or 4 nights. And then from Munich, I went back to Amsterdam. And I think when I was getting ready to leave to go back home, I was only in Amsterdam for like maybe 2 days, and then I flew back. So I kind of did like a big circle around like Western Europe, basically. Although, like I said, I didn't really get to spend a whole lot of time in Paris. I did get to see Amsterdam and Rome and Vienna and Munich, which were all really, really cool cities. Amsterdam was really, really cool, I thought. We did a I did like a walking tour, throughout the old town. They took you to like the red light district and like, all over basically, all over like the main part of like the downtown area. And I thought it was really, really cool. There was a lot of tourists, there was a lot of foreigners, a lot of it was kind of there was definitely like some seedy areas. It's probably even worse now. I mean, this was back in 2006. But I thought Amsterdam was a really cool place. Paris was like a way, way bigger, crazier city than I was expecting. I was a little bit overwhelmed with Paris, to be honest with you. I ended up booking a hostel, and I didn't really know where it was. I just found it online, and it was pretty cheap. And it ended up being like kind of in the suburbs of Paris, so it was like way out of the way. And it wasn't really the nicest area either. There was a lot of again, a lot of like foreigners in this area, like a lot of like the Muslims and the blacks from former French
Right,
colonies and stuff.
North Africa, yep.
Right. So it wasn't the best area, but I mean, again, I was only there for like a day, so I went to the hotel or the hostel, I guess, and dropped off my stuff, and then just took the train back down into like the main part of Paris and kind of walked around for a night. And then, Rome and Munich and Vienna were all great. I won't, get into all the details, but that was basically my experience traveling in Europe. One of the coolest things that happened, and I got to mention this, and then I'll kind of turn it over to you. When I was doing the study abroad program in Italy, the World Cup was going on. The World Cup was being played in Germany. And, again, I grew up in Nebraska and, totally clueless about soccer. I never followed it. I still don't really follow it. I had no idea even the World Cup was going on. And so I show up in Europe, and everybody's, they're all crazy about it, and everybody's into it. And I end up, making it to Italy, and Italy's advancing, and next thing you know, Italy's in the championship, and Italy beats France and wins the World Cup while I'm there.
Oh,
And
wow.
yeah, it was super cool. I was in this little town. And oh man, it was such a cool experience. Everybody was going crazy. They had like, next thing I know, it was kind of late at night. It was probably like 9 or 10 at night by the time the game got over. And everybody's out in the streets and partying and celebrating and singing and
And that's in this little medieval town?
in this little town, yeah,
Wow.
this little town, yeah. So it was cool. It was a really, really cool experience. And probably once in a lifetime. I didn't plan on I didn't like I said, I didn't even I wasn't even really aware about the World Cup. I mean, I think the World Cup is much more popular in America now than it was back then. I mean, I don't think there was too many people really into the World Cup back then. At least
No.
none of my friends were. Like, I didn't even pay attention to it.
Yeah, when I was
So
young, we didn't. They didn't even have a soccer was nothing. It was just like a European, a game that foreigners played. I think my senior year in high school, which was 70, 71, was the first year they had a soccer team. And even then, it was just, I just never caught. Well, it's caught on now. It's pretty big now. But
It's definitely a lot bigger now than it was back then,
Oh,
for
yeah.
sure. I mean, people are really into it now. But I was totally clueless. And you go to Europe, and it's obviously like the biggest event, the biggest sporting event of
Yeah.
the year. I mean, I think it's only what, every 4 years anyways. So it's like, it's a really big deal to people. So
It
that
sounds
was
like you had a
cool.
good time.
Yeah, that
How
was
many?
really cool.
How much time? It sounds like you. How long were you in Europe for
It was
on this
a it
trip?
was about a month. It was like a little
Oh
over a
wow, you
month.
did a lot.
Yeah, it was like a little over a month.
That was basically the first time I went to Europe was 1978. I started off. I flew to London. I mostly hitchhiked around England and Scotland. Then, like you, I crossed over by ferry to France, and like you, I had a Eurail pass. And back then, I don't know if it's as easy going today, or say when you had it as when I had it, but you could just hop. It was great. You could just hop on and off a train, no reservations, no nothing. And when I did it, I don't know if it was the same with you. Did you go like it was a first class thing because they could never, most people don't go second class. So. And you could sleep. You could pull the seats. If you wanted to take an overnight trip, you could pull the seats that were opposite each other together and make a bed out of that. Did you do that as well?
Yeah, I definitely had one sleeper car when I took the train from Paris to Italy. And
could you just jump on and off without making any reservations?
I think you could have, but I basically like wanted, I just wanted to make sure that like I had a spot. So I pretty much would always go to the train station like a day before I wanted to go anywhere, or maybe 2 days or whatever, and just like book my ticket or whatever. And it was, yeah, it was a pretty simple, easy process.
Yeah, like I said, when I was there, you know, I mean, most people don't go to first class compartments. At most, there would be one or two people. You know, they have the 6 people sit in them, but usually there was usually like usually sometimes they were empty, and sometimes there would just be one or two people. You know, and they were all, you
Yeah.
know, so they
Yeah,
weren't
it
really
wasn't
like,
bad.
yeah, no. So yeah, that was my, and I raced all over the place, even more so than you. You know, I went from from Norway to Greece and almost every place in between. I didn't go to Spain and Portugal on that trip, but I think I covered pretty much all of Western Europe on that trip. But some, you know, I didn't really see it properly. But you know, for my first trip to Europe, it was okay. You know, I got a quick view of everything, and you know, I've been back after that. I've been back several times and been taking it slower and just concentrating on maybe two or three countries at a time for a month or 6 weeks, something like that. So
Yeah,
yeah, so
if I go back, I definitely want to do like another month, and I think, and I mentioned this before we started recording, I think I want to do like Eastern Europe, like Romania,
well, you should. We're going to
Bulgaria.
be talking about
Yeah.
that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I didn't run by you. I don't know. You know, we're going to be talking about communism. I was, you know, I was there in, I saw, I believe, 7 countries in the communist era, mostly in 1978 and 1980. But one thing I didn't mention, I don't know, one of the most notorious communists of our time, he's a communist in everything but name, it turned 100 today. Did you know that?
No, who are you referring to?
Oh, you take a guess.
George Soros?
No, Henry Kissinger. It's his 100th birthday
Oh,
today.
Henry. Oh my gosh. He's 100
Yeah.
years old? Oh my gosh. And this guy's still going to the Bilderberg meeting. He's still involved in
Yeah.
politics. He's still
You
out
know, and
there advising. You know, he's
he's
got
just no.
Kissinger and associates. Man, this guy just will. These guys, they got to be doing something to
You
keep
know,
him
I think
alive
about
this long.
these Jewish communists that have lived such a long, lived such a full life. And, you know, I ask myself, why isn't there any justice? I'm thinking of it like Lazar Kaganovich. I'm sure you're familiar with him, right? Stalin's
Oh,
right-hand man.
yeah, definitely.
Yeah, he lived to like 97. He died peacefully in bed. Then Armin Hammer, who was a big, I think he lived into his 90s as well. He was a big businessman who did a lot of business with, who got rich while people were being butchered in Russia, you know,
Oh,
back in the
yeah.
20s and 30s. So, you know,
Speaking of
yeah, for.
Kissinger, I just read a report the other day in Russia Today. And well, here, I'll just read the headline to you. Kissinger behind 3 million civilian deaths. And this is according to an in-depth investigative report by The Intercept, which is an outlet originally founded by Glenn Greenwald. And I don't follow The Intercept, but they do some decent reporting, but I think they've definitely kind of sold out. I mean, Glenn Greenwald quit and because they weren't living up to their principles. But anyways, yeah, this was an interesting report, and they got a image, they got a photo of Kissinger, with this article, and this is just the ugliest looking guy. I mean, he's so old, he's
Oh
so
God, he
just
is
an the
decrepit.
it like evil incarnate like in this man's
He is
face.
absolutely. Yeah. He's done. He's pretty much roamed the world, just wrecking nations and getting involved. Well, you know, in Vietnam, he was heavily
Vietnam,
involved.
Cambodia, I
And there
mean.
was just one area I didn't even know about at the time it was going on, was that island in Indonesia, Timor, if I'm pronouncing it right, Timor.
Yeah, East Timor, yeah.
East Timor, and
Yeah.
then of course in the south, and no, Rhodesia, and yeah, he's just born to destroy, just like George Soros, just born to bring countries to their knees, and just you know, he's just a destroyer. That's really the only the one word that describes him. So anyway, all right, so you let me can we let me is there anything else you wanted to say about Kissinger before we get started? Am I
No. Let's go
okay?
ahead and jump in
All
to
right.
your experiences in Europe.
Yeah, one thing, you know, I just are you familiar with a book called None Dare Call It Treason by John Stormer?
I remember None Dare Call It a Conspiracy. There's another
Yeah,
book.
that was Gary Allen. That
Okay.
came later.
None.
This
Oh
book.
no, I don't think I've read it then.
Oh really? Wow. This book. I had never. This book was the first book I ever read that really that put the world into focus. What was going on? It's about communism, but it's about the communist conspiracy. And I happened to have when I majored in philosophy in college, I took some classes with a very conservative professor, and we had a lot of good discussions in the Rathskeller School. Anyway, he recommended a couple of books that I read, and this was one of them. This was the first book I ever read that made me politically aware about what's going on in the world. It just because I could never figure out what communism was all about. You know, I grew up. I'm thinking now of elementary school, and we used to have. This is really in the heart of the Cold War, and we would have. You know, the Russians were the bad guys. You know, communism was evil, and yet some people would just mock that, you know, and make fun of that. We would have drills sometimes. You must have heard about that back in the '60s, ducking under our desks in case of a Russian nuclear attack. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah
talk about a fear-based mind control program right there.
Yeah, I could never figure out what communism was all about, but it kind of fascinated me in a way. So that always stuck in my mind. So I said, you know, when I go to Europe, I want to see what communism is like, you know. And after I read this book, you know, he discusses basically. He avoids the Jewish angle, but there are so many Jewish names in the index that you know you can put two and two together. But basically, on a good part of this book and he's not like it wasn't anti. He doesn't really get into Hitler and Nazism. And he's not. There's nothing in this book to indicate that he was against World War II, but he does talk about all the secret deals that Roosevelt and Churchill made at the end of the war, that basically sold out Eastern Europe. And he talks about China, and other stuff that was going on in Central America. So that book really, when I read this book, that made me understand a good part of communism. So I became kind of fascinated with it, and I said, you know, I want to see some of these places when I go to Europe. And like I said, I did two weeks in England and Scotland, and I had to then like a month pretty much going all over the place. But I wanted to squeeze a few places in. The first place I went to was Berlin, East Berlin, and it was a very strange experience. You know, it sounds so weird now. I mean, now we're, you know, most people listening – can't imagine what it was like then. Berlin, of course, as you know, at the end of the war, the Allies took over West Berlin and the Soviets East Berlin. Now, Berlin, it was in the middle of East Germany, and I kind of wanted to see East Germany too, but some of these countries, they varied. There was a lot of red tape involved in visiting them, and East Germany was probably the worst. So as far as – it was just too complicated. Getting
I mean, you could do it, but it was just a lot of hoops to jump through to even get into
the
country.
Some of them weren't like that, and I'll get to that. But East Germany was just too much of a I didn't want to deal with that. They'd give you a transit visa when you crossed. So basically, what you had to do is you had to buy a ticket from I bought a ticket. I'm looking at a map of Europe now. I think probably Frankfurt to Berlin. So, but then you have to go into East Berlin, East Germany, to get to Berlin. So, you know, most of the time you're just, riding along in this communist country. And one thing, so obviously I didn't see anything of the country. I do remember just going through and seeing people standing as the train would go through towns, larger towns, people just standing by and just looking at the train going by. And they look kind of, maybe I'm reading too much into this, but they look kind of sad. It was like a wistful kind of look, like this train is coming from where I can't go, you know, free West Germany, you know. I just had that kind of feeling. And then, you know, we got to West Berlin, and I always wanted to see, you know, I wanted to go through the Berlin Wall. And that was basically, it was pretty straightforward. There was a station called Checkpoint Charlie. Do you remember that? Does that name ring a bell?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
those were all the, like, the What was it? The British, the Americans, the
And the French,
Soviets, and the
I think the
French,
French section. Yeah, it says you were leaving the American British sector, and so you had to go through that. It was pretty easy, and then there I was. I walked through the Berlin Wall, and I just pretty much, and you know, it's something like 100. I don't, at least 100 people were shot dead trying to escape. And right at Checkpoint Charlie, there was a little museum, and I still have this little book with pictures of some of the people that were killed trying to escape. And I just walked around East Berlin for a couple of hours. There were still places, you know, it was a modern city, but very, very low key, very somber, which is what a lot of these countries, among communist countries, were like. There were still some buildings there had been bombed during World War II that had never been demolished. Not a lot, but I still remember some of them. And I remember going into a, I went to a bar, a Rathskeller, you know, like a bar that you just walk downstairs. And I had a beer there, and I just sitting around, and people just seemed very low key. You could really, I could, you could sense it. You could sense the bleakness of it. That's the word, the bleakness of it. And Berlin really stands out in my mind as far as that goes. So I'm looking at the map here. I didn't keep a diary, so I'm just kind of. I went back into West Germany and into Austria, and from there I went into Hungary. I guess I took the train from Vienna to Budapest. Beautiful city. Budapest is a beautiful city. But I remember, and this is like the first time now I'm going to be traveling in a communist country. And at that time, I still, my first memory was hung. I would say back then, Hungary was kind of like an average country as far as repression goes. It wasn't that bad. And I remember there was a woman on the train. She was Hungarian, and she once we crossed the border from Austria into Hungary, the train stopped for a while, and it was some kind of military or police shouting at this woman. She had done something wrong. You know, obviously I couldn't understand the conversation, and she had a very kind of a terrified look on her face. And yet she had come from Austria back into Hungary, so I imagine they let people travel a little bit out of the country into the free, you know, what was then the free West. But that was my very, you know, I still have that image of that woman. And then we went on to into Budapest, and I had a guidebook, and it said people would come up to you and ask if you wanted to. They were allowed to let you stay at in their apartments, you know, to make a little money, but you had to report to the police station, you know, just give them the details. So this guy came up to me, and that's exactly what happened. This guy came up to me, and we went to the police station, and I stayed at his place, and I walked around Budapest. It was I like Hungary. Hungary. Like I said, Budapest is a beautiful city. The cuisine is great. And then I moved on into I stayed there for maybe 2 days, 3 days, and then I stayed at a city called Szeged, Szeged, which is near the Yugoslav border. I don't really remember a lot. All I can remember basically is that it wasn't too bad as far as repression. Then I went on to Yugoslavia. And Yugoslavia, well, of course, it's broken up since then. It's now seven different countries. And I worked my way down to Greece. And of all the communist countries I went to, it was very pretty much easygoing. There was really nothing repressive about it that I could sense. It wasn't really my favorite country. I don't remember
Was
too much
it,
about it.
I was gonna say, what was it like, sort of modern, or was it, did it seem kind of run down and sort of economically
A little bit.
depressed?
Yeah, a little, somewhat more so than Eastern than in Western Europe, and not really that bad. Pretty modern. It really it didn't. What surprised me actually, I had not been aware of this. As I worked my way down, I stayed a night in a town called Skopje, Skopje, and I didn't realize that and there were mosques there, and this is Europe, and you know I didn't know much about the history of the area, but you know. Back in the day, I mean, the Turks had occupied the Balkan countries, and some of them, like that part of Yugoslavia, was Islamic, as is
Now that's
Albania.
Macedonia, right? Modern
I don't
Macedonia?
know.
Skopje?
It might be. I
Yeah,
do have a map. Are you looking at a map?
yeah, yeah.
Which
No,
one
it
is
is
it?
Macedonia.
Oh, Macedonia. Okay. And that's pretty much closer to Greece, right? I'm looking at a map. I'm looking at a map that's not very detailed.
Yeah,
So.
it's like directly north of Greece. Like
Okay.
Albania is north of Greece. Macedonia is directly north of Greece. Bulgaria kind of borders Greece if you go further east. But yeah, Macedonia is a small country. And I think this was another one of the Yugoslav republics.
Well, you mean now,
Because.
today, Macedonia?
Well, I mean, but well, back then, I mean, Yugoslavia was Serbia, Bosnia,
Wait, no,
Montenegro. Yeah.
back then, back when I visited it, I didn't even know those. Maybe I did, but it was just Yugoslavia.
Well,
It was
right, yeah, it
just
was one big, like, you
one
know,
big
country,
country.
but it was comprised of these different, like, regions.
I'm sure there were administrative regions with their
Yeah.
own names, but I wasn't really, I didn't pay too much attention to that at the time.
Gotcha, okay.
Of course, today it's totally different. And then I went to Greece and went to Athens. Then I ended up taking the ferry over to Italy, and then back, I ended up back in, still using my rail pass. Went through Italy, and then it was pretty, that was kind of near the end. I only had 1 week left or something like that. And ended up taking the ferry from France over to England again. I flew home on from London again. So that was my first trip.
Man,
So
that's
I did
a
get a little.
you did you went all over on your first trip. Wow.
Well, I didn't even mention I went to up to Scandinavia as well. I went to Denmark and Norway and Sweden. But just sometimes I would just take overnight trips on the train, just really rushing around. Like I said, looking back, since I have had the opportunity to return to Europe several times, it was a good introduction to the continent. But I never, it's not, if you're gonna go to Europe once, I would say just concentrate on just a few countries. Don't rush around like that. But whatever. So then in 1980, I went. I started in 1980. I flew to Japan. I flew to Tokyo, and I think I was in Japan for about 17 or 18 days, mostly hitchhiking. It's the easiest country in the world to hitchhike in. My God, it was so easy. It was annoying. Sometimes I would get out of a car. I just wanted to be left alone. I'd stick my thumb out. Within 60 seconds, I'd get a lift.
Wait,
So,
which country is this?
Japan.
Oh, in Japan. Oh, okay, we're going to Japan now.
Well, that's what I just want to say. That's where I started my trip. I was in Japan for about 18 days, and now at that time, Russia also was a country that it was possible to visit. Another thing I don't I should maybe I should have mentioned this. The other countries in Eastern Europe that I went to. And then I'm going to talk about the other ones that I went to. There were very few foreign tourists. I mean, there was just something kind of scary about communism. I guess at the time people figured, just like when I went to North Korea, people figured you might disappear. But it wasn't really, if you'd be, I had, well, I did have problems in Romania. I'll get to that. But again, if you just follow the rules and behave like an adult, it was not, it was really nothing to worry about. So the reason I mentioned Japan was because I took, well, at that time, it was again like East Germany. It was possible to go to Russia if you wanted to do well. If you wanted to jump through, a dozen hoops, which I didn't want to do, but I did hook up with a. I don't know how I hooked up with them, but it was an Australian company called Sundowners. So I booked a trip, the Trans-Siberian, with them, and that trip actually began in Yokohama. That's where we met up. It was a 2-day ferry. From Yokohama to the Pacific coast of Siberia. Now at that time, it was not possible to go. This was 1980. Now, it was not possible to go to Vladivostok. That's the terminal of the Trans-Siberian, and at that time it was a big naval base. So the trip actually began in a city called Nohodka, which is about 50 miles north of Vladivostok. But you talk about, well, we talked about this once before, the feeling of being in a completely remote. I remember coming in after 2 days on the ferry, just the first sight of land, and you're on the edge. You talk about remote. I remember seeing these big escarpments just sticking out of the ocean as we drew near land, and I said, "Wow, this is the other side of the world." I mean, Siberia is synonymous with that, but this is
Well,
like the
it
eastern.
quite literally is like the other end of the
It
world.
is,
Yeah.
I had that feeling. So we that's where we that's where the trip began. So what we did was, I think we stayed in Nahoka for maybe 2 days. And then, you know, I have a lot of little notes jotted down. We then working our way west, what we would do is we slept on the train, you know, and it's the longest train trip in the world. I think it spans one third of the globe. I mean, from, you know, in the middle of the globe, if you go around, I think that's 25,000 miles. And I think this trip is like 8,000 miles, something like that.
Oh my gosh. That's unbelievable.
So we would stop. We stopped in Nahoka for a couple of days, then a city called Irkutsk, which is right on Lake Baikal. Do you have a map in front of you? I don't know if you're looking at a map.
I am. Yeah, yeah. Okay. I'm trying to kind of follow you. You said what's the name of the lake?
Lake Baikal. I think it's the deepest lake. I think it's the deepest lake in the world. I'm not sure. I'm looking at a map of Russia, but it's not
showing. I see
Irkutsk.
Oh, Irkutsk it's called? Okay.
It should stand out. It should.
Well, looking at the map, I mean, I'm just on like Google Maps. I mean, to go from like sort of like the southern tip of Siberia, you'd have to go north unless you're going through China. Did you guys travel through China?
No, but I think we pretty much skirted the border of China on the way to Irkutsk, I believe.
Okay.
Very close to the
border.
Anyway, so then it was Irkutsk. We stayed there for 2 nights. Then if you go further west, Novosibirsk, which is, I think, pretty much dead center in the old Soviet Union. It's a good-sized city. And then on to Moscow and back then it was called Leningrad, St. Petersburg. So I think, as I recall, we spent 2 nights in each of these cities. And like I said, we spent some nights on it. We spent, I think, most nights on a train. Now, what I got to tell you is I got very sick. this is one of the many things about Russia. I've been to 97 countries. The food in Russia, it was the absolute worst in the world. It was absolutely horrible food that we ate on the train, even in the hotels. It was very...
What were they feeding you guys? Or what did they have for sale?
What I remember is we would have soup. We would have soup, I think, for lunch. And I don't even remember. I think maybe we had a hard-boiled egg for breakfast. And I remember on each of the rail cars, there was a samovar. There was a tea. You could go get tea at any time, which was kind of nice. But, you know, I'm a real foodie. I like good food. And it was funny because before I started that trip, I got a little Russian language phrase book, and I'm going, you know, it's an impossible language, really, but I remember going through some of the dishes, like rabbit in cream sauce, you know, caribou with mushrooms and gravy. I'm saying, wow, this sounds really like my kind of place. I really want to try some of these dishes. And you get there, and there's like nothing like that at all. All I remember was they would feed us soup, which had like just old vegetables, potatoes, cabbage, and there was some meat in it, but it was just gristle. I didn't know what it was, and it was really hard. It was just terrible. So one of the most colorful things about that trip, especially way out east, was the train would stop in these little towns for about 5 minutes, and these old peasant women I think they call them babushkas, babushkas. They're a little allowance of free enterprise. They were selling like pickles and mushrooms and coleslaw. So, and that was good. You know, I bought this stuff a lot and I ate a lot of it. And it's something in that food somewhere along the way made me very sick. And I was able to do the trip, but I always had to make sure there was a toilet not too far away, if you know what I mean.
Oh,
And this continued the whole time I was in Russia. I couldn't, and you know, I was just hoping it would go. Eventually, it did go away. Once I was back, once we got to like Poland, and you know, after we left the country, I started feeling better. But for 11 or 12 days, I was just, you know, I wasn't, I didn't feel good at all. But and then when we got to Moscow and St. Petersburg, the food was a little bit better in the hotels, but really not that good. I didn't have one decent meal in that country. You know, and the funny thing was, I remember I ran into a guy 19 years later, in 1999, He had gone to Russia. He was a doctor. He went there on some kind of medical mission. And he came back. He said it was the same thing. He said the food was absolutely horrible. I imagine it's better now. I know now they have some of the Western chains, you know, McDonald's, Starbucks. I don't know what's going on there now. But anyway, that's one of the things that really that I'll never forget about that country.
Now, this and, what year was this when you did this Trans-Siberian trip?
1980.
Okay, so it was
43 years ago.
Getting towards the more of the tail end of the Soviet Union. What was it like? I mean, it was obviously pretty developed if they have this huge rail network, but I mean, was it thriving? What were the people like?
No.
What was your general take? Yeah.
Yeah, I'll tell you, it's one of the shabbiest countries that I've ever been to. There's one word I could describe the whole country. It's shabby. The people were not, you know, I still have a few images even from that long ago. One of them was in Irkutsk. I went into a little church. I'll never forget this. There was a woman with a real weather-beaten face giving the sign of the cross over and over. It was very moving, you know. It was just, you know, there was just a little bit of a religious spirit. And I guess they did have the freedom to go to church. I didn't really inquire. I didn't really have any talks with any of the Russian people, although some people in the group did. It was all Australians and New Zealanders. There was about 15 of us. So I didn't really have any conversations. I guess I should have. I could have. But I still remember that scene of this woman. And it was just, I don't remember if there was music in the church, but it was just very, it was very moving. Just to look at that old wrinkled face and seeing her give the sign of the cross with all the, the icons of, I guess, the Russian Eastern Orthodox religion. And another thing, I still remember this, in one of the train stations, and I think it was the only place I ever saw ice cream sold in the country. This woman was selling ice cream. She had a big lump of vanilla ice cream. This is just a very small thing, but somebody had just bought some ice cream from her and said a bad word, and she was just muttering at him, just very very angry, just muttering. And that just stands out in my mind. That was in a train station. I forget where. It might have been in Novosibirsk. You know, and there's another thing I want to tell you about the train stations. It was this another writer who had been to Russia around this time described the smell of those train stations. It was very interesting how he described it. He said it was a combination of body odor, rotten cabbage, and bad cigarette smoke. It's just a and that's a very good description. It was all the train stations, the five or six that we stopped in, had that same old, tired, very unpleasant smell. It sounds weird, but
ugh, does not sound pleasant.
It wasn't like a nauseating smell, but just a very unpleasant, tired smell. And, you know, and another thing about these countries is that, you know, back then I smoked cigarettes. You know, I quit a long time ago, but back then I smoked cigarettes. I was a light cigarette smoker. And in these countries, this is going to sound funny, but, you know, when I smell cigarette smoke around here now, it's kind of a pleasant, not a pleasant smell, but it's not an offensive smell. But they must have cut their tobacco with paper or something, and it was I couldn't smoke their cigarettes. It was just a very cheap, I think they must cut the tobacco with paper, with just ordinary paper, and stuff the cigarettes with them, because the cigarette smoke, it was just very unpleasant smelling. You know, it's not the kind of thing. It's just something that sticks out in my mind. All those Eastern European countries, not only Russia, just very cheap products. So, you know, there's a few other things that stick out. I have a few other images. I remember this woman walking by the railroad track somewhere, just in this shabby overcoat, and it just looked like that she was like just beaten down by life. She was carrying, I think, a pail of potatoes. And another thing I remember about just going through these, you know, and the Siberia is mostly just, you know, what they call the steppes. You've heard that word, I'm sure, right?
Right. Yeah.
Plains going on forever.
Kind of. I'd imagine it's kind of like the Midwest here, right? But maybe a little bit.
No, well, not too. Yeah, not somewhat similar, you know.
Well, maybe not as many trees or as green,
Yeah.
kind of
Well,
more, yeah, like
although
deserty.
we passed through a lot of birch tree forests as well, which were kind of pleasant. And it was in September. It was a pleasant month to be traveling. So, those are the things that stand out in my mind. And then I remember we got to Moscow, and I don't know if you're familiar with it. They had what they call Berezovka shops back then, and people would come up, and people wanted to. The big thing with when people, ordinary Russians, ran into Western travelers is they wanted to buy your jeans. They had blue jeans, but they were very cheap, and real. They were just made like, and you could say they were just like made like garbage. And so Levi's were a huge thing. If you wore Levi's, they wanted to buy them off you. And another thing I remember was there were shops, and this was only in Moscow, maybe in St. Petersburg and Leningrad as well. They had what they call Berezovka shops, which were only for foreigners. And there you could buy Marlboro cigarettes. You could buy chocolate. I remember Toblerone, which is I think they still make Toblerone. I think it's a Swiss company. You know, it's good
Yeah, oh
chocolate.
yeah, I know, I've heard of it, yeah.
Yeah, it's quality chocolate. You could only buy that. Only Westerners could buy them, and only specialized shops. You know, I think
So
they must have had certain.
you had to like show your foreign passport to even get into a shop like that?
I don't remember what it was like. I think they were in the hotels, and I think, there were. Somehow they knew you were a foreigner. I forget if I had to show my passport or if they were completely off limits. If they were in areas that where ordinary Russians couldn't go, I don't remember, but. They would. You could only buy them in Western currency as well.
I was going to
So that
ask
was.
about the money. Did you have to convert your money, or did you mostly just stick with the dollar?
We everything was pretty much bought and paid for. I mean, everything was booked ahead of time. So I don't remember. I should have really kept a diary and kept record of this stuff. I don't remember if we changed over to rubles. I think we must have for just to buy a few things off the street. Another thing they had was. I remember in Moscow they had a beverage called kvass, KVASS, and they said I remember our tour guide said you should try this, and that was another thing that was horrible. It was like their version of beer, very low alcohol, but it tasted horrible. I really couldn't stand it. And I think they still sell it. I just went on the internet a few days ago, and they sell it. There was like these barrels on wheels. They sell it out of, and now I don't know if they have ordinary beer good beer that people can buy these days. I don't know. But
What about the vodka? They're known for vodka, right?
they yes I don't we must have had some vodka in the in the restaurants during mealtime. It's not something that really stands out in my mind, but another what I want to mention about Russia as well is that it's a very I want to read something to you from there's a book called Racial Realities in Europe. Have you heard of that book? It was
Who wrote it?
Lothrop Stoddard,
Okay,
very famous.
yeah. I've never read it, but I've heard of it.
This is written in 1924, and it's a very interesting thing. And he talks a lot about. He really gets into the racial situation all throughout Europe, and even discussing all the subtle differences between the different Caucasian and the different white stocks as well. He really goes into that. I mean, he's very pro-Nordic, okay, but he, he talks about the different temperaments and everything of the different, as I said, the different Mediterranean, Alpine. He talks about it a lot in the Nordics. And anyway, let me read you this one paragraph. And remember, this is written 90, 100 years ago. Beyond Poland lies Russia, vast and incalculable. This immense region of huge forests, boundless prairies, and illimitable plains is the borderland of Europe and Asia. Here, diverse races have wandered, fought and mingled, producing strange blends and equally strange contrasts of blood, temperament, and ideals. Despite all the thought and investigation devoted to it, Russia remains essentially unknown, not merely to foreigners, but even to Russians themselves. Many Russians frankly admit that the soul of Russia is still an enigma, a mystery. Bolshevism is merely the last of a long series of strange Russian developments which have surprised the world, and Russia probably has other startling surprises yet in store. So that's very interesting because when you, especially out east, you would see a fair amount of people that obviously had some Mongoloid features, you know, mixed Mongoloid and Caucasian. And you know, I'm going to get ahead of things here for a second. When I went back to the old Soviet Union, to Kazakhstan, I remember flying in at 2 a.m. and in customs, I saw there was a one of the officials there. This is 2007. A woman with blonde hair and slanty eyes, and I'd never seen that anywhere in the world. So, as Stoddard said, there's some very strange racial mingling going on. And you would see people, even back then in 1980, especially in the Far East, you would see a fair amount of Mongolian people-looking people. And I got to say that I don't. Are you familiar with one of Putin's top generals, which is, you know, I'm talking about today now.
Shoigu. Shoigu, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Okay, yep. So you see, he has a very strange face. You know, you've seen, I imagine you picked up on his Asiatic features.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what he is. I'll look it up right now. Shoigu.
He doesn't look European. But he looks quite European.
No, yeah, he's definitely mixed with something. Yeah, Sergei Shoigu. He's, I want to say, some Central Asian.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah. I saw that in Kazakhstan. He looks like a typical inhabitant of
so
Kazakhstan.
So his father is ethnically Tuvan.
Yeah, which gets very strange.
Which is, yeah, like a Turkic-like ethnic group.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot of, like, small tribes, like, all over, like, in that, you know, in Central Asia, like...
Well, that's, you know, Stoddard gets into that. He gets into his whole point. He talks about Russia a lot. I can't read too much from his book, but he just talks about the way that Russia is always, and this, remember, again, this is 100 years ago. It's just a country that does not have any really true European identity, although most people are, especially when you get further west. I mean, there's you know, a lot of good-looking people. A lot of them look Scandinavian, but there's a lot of mixture there, too. And Stoddard talked about why that country is, it really can't. It's always going to be very unsettled, and there's never going to be any real stability because racially it's an unstable country. That was his point. You know, and another thing, I don't know if you saw this on a Renegade Tribune just a few days ago. Putin, they have a dating app, and there was a little video of it where. European women are encouraged to – it's a dating app to match European women, Russian women, with Chinese people. That's an encouragement.
No kidding. I didn't see that.
Yeah. You should look at it. It's on Renegade. It was just a couple of days ago. And this is apparently – Putin believe, and this is, again, I think this is what Kyle Hunt says on the on his website. And he's probably right that Putin is – it encourages this Eurasian. He wants to create a Eurasian race. He believes in that, but he's saying that Putin believes in that. So it's very strange, you know. And it's not something that I would want to, that I would ever encourage or support. It's very strange. So you do have that element of racial instability in Russia. Again, not completely. I mean, it's a lot of most Russians are. You know, are definitely European people, but that's one of the strange things about Russia. And
yeah, I'm still like a little just confused about like Putin's racial views, I guess, because he does like I've seen speeches and in papers and stuff where he's written about how like the ethnic Russians, like white, you know, Russians are basically a European peoples and sort of form like the bedrock of the entire civilization. They're like the natural leaders, the natural.
He has said that.
Yeah, I mean he's basically made that argument, but then he talks about like how it's a multiracial empire or multiracial federation, I guess. I don't think he'd necessarily say empire. And then I just saw an article the other day where it was quoting Putin. Hold on one second, I'll find it right here. It was on RT. Yeah, Putin saying like, oh, like the West. You know, they misunderstand Russia's strength and diversity. And he literally sounded like a Joe Biden or like one of these Democrats. He says here, this is directly from Putin. Our nation was built on the value of multinational harmony. It's the most important foundation of our consolidation, which only becomes stronger in the face of foreign pressure and threats. And then he goes on to say here, people with neocolonial thinking who do not understand that this diversity makes us stronger.
Oh, boy.
I mean, doesn't that sound like something like Biden would say? Like, diversity is our strength? Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So,
So I don't know. I to me, that's not a very smart way of looking at the situation, because I think if you look at all throughout history, diversity only leads to conflict and, you know, a loss of social cohesion. And there's, you know, plenty of studies that demonstrate this. And all you got to do is look at modern America to see that on full display.
Yeah, so
Well, and another thing is nobody really thinks like this except for, you know, brainwashed white goyim who just, you know, blindly accept Jewish propaganda. I mean, this is a Jewish narrative that white people just for some reason uncritically accept. Meanwhile, no other group of people is out there saying that, you know, diversity is our strength. They strongly identify with their racial or ethnic group.
Of course.
And,
well,
and
we
organize.
You know, everybody listening to your show knows that, well, you know, the insanity of that. But here you have Putin, you know, speaking out in support of diversity. And yet he has some good views.
Exactly.
You know, he's a moral guy. I mean, I think you've said some, you know, I've looked at your website. You've said some positive things about him that I agree with. But, you know, so a lot of these people seem to have, some of these leaders and other people seem to be like, they see, in some ways they see things so clearly, and in other ways they believe in the most destructive doctrines, you know. So it's just it's such a crazy world. So so anyway, that was my impression of Russia. Then we just that trip we went all the way to London. So we crossed Poland. I went to Poland. I don't think we're gonna have time to talk about all this stuff. I went to Poland back in 1981 later. But that on that trip we crossed it in the daytime, and I was just looking out the window. So I only remember seeing a farmer plowing his fields with a horse. That's the only thing that I remember. You know, I can imagine the train stopped in Warsaw, but I don't remember that. Then they, you know, we went on through Germany and France and crossed over into England. So that was a trip to remember. I just wish I had been feeling better. Although, like I said, I got to do, you know, I did get to walk around and do things, but I was not feeling too well. So.
Yeah, boy, you got to be careful when you're traveling. It's bound to happen, you know, when you're in a foreign country. Well, geez, even sometimes that happens even here, you know.
Yeah, I mean, even well, back then, I mean, you know, in some of these Eastern, even today, my last trip, I went to Georgia. I'm not going to have time to talk about that, but you really had to be, you know, Georgia, which was it used to be part of the Soviet Union in the Caucasus. And you really have to be careful what you ate over there too, and avoiding the water like the plague. So, we're running out of time, but how much time do we have left, John?
About 15 minutes or so.
All right. What I did on that trip, actually, my girlfriend flew over from the States to London, and we met up in London. We met up in London, and then we went back. It's really kind of a crazy trip. Then we went back. We took the Magic Bus. I don't know if that still runs. Back then, there was something called the Magic Bus. It went from London to Athens. And we went to we got out, actually. We didn't go all the way. We didn't go to Athens. We got out in Yugoslavia. So I was in Yugoslavia again. And from there, I quickly went to Romania, which, after North Korea, is the most repressive country I've ever been to. Completely different from Yugoslavia, which, you know, it's next door neighbor. That was during the rule of Ceausescu, who was really, you know, one of the worst communist dictators. And I remember one of my first...
Now, real quick, Ceausescu was the guy that ended up getting killed, right, in a revolution?
He was executed on Christmas Day in 1989.
Yeah, like they overthrew him and, yeah, okay.
Yeah,
I don't know all those details, but I do remember reading about that, yeah.
You can watch him and his wife. It was really quite dramatic. It's on YouTube. The army and the military turned against him, and they arrested him, and they brought him back to Bucharest, and he was given like a quick trial. It was like an hour. You can watch this on YouTube. They cut it down to about 10 minutes. You know, it's in Romanian, but the English subtitles. It's really dramatic.
So he was just like a corrupt, you know, scumbag, basically?
A total scumbag. I mean, his people were starving. You know, they had horrible food. They had no fuel in the wintertime. You know, a lot, thousands of them died from malnutrition, from the cold. And anyway, he was overthrown. And you could actually watch the quick, it was like a kangaroo trial. But it was a real trial. I mean, he deserved to, him and his wife both deserved to be executed. Then they were taken out into a courtyard, and they were killed by firing squad. You could watch that, except, you know, it's a little bloody, but the actual bullets hitting them were obscured by gun smoke, so you know you're not going to see that. But it's a very dramatic. It's like a 10-minute clip. And I,
yeah, no, you had just said you could watch the clip on YouTube.
Yeah, yeah, it's very interesting to watch. Anyway,
but it was like noticeably like oppressive. Like as soon as got there, basically.
We went to, you know, and the funny thing was, it was very easy to travel around. We didn't see any other foreign tourists, but it was very easy to travel around. We went to the first town, which was not far from the Yugoslav border, was called Timisoara. And that's where I think, that's where the big rebellion started in 1989, when people just couldn't take it anymore, and eventually led up to the army turning against him. I remember
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but real quick, is that the old like medieval like German town? Because there was a lot of like Germans that had like settled in that part of Romania, if I'm not mistaken.
I remember we went to a beautiful old medieval town called Sigisoara, really really beautiful.
The one I'm thinking of. I think there was towns in this region like kind of. I guess it's Western or like maybe Northern Romania that were there. There were a lot of German, you know, settlers in this area.
I think Germans have showed up, you know, throughout Eastern Europe and settled.
Right, right, true.
Yeah, I'm sure they did in Romania as well. Now when we were in Timisoara, which was a good sized town, I remember we ran into a boy and a girl. They were about 15, 16 years old, and they spoke English. They were very, very pleasant. You know, they were asking us a lot of questions. All of a sudden, the girl goes, "Police, police!" And we turn around, and there was this guy in uniform staring at us like from 50 yards away. So those people were absolutely paranoid about being caught even speaking to a foreigner. And I remember he was just staring at us. And I think eventually he just walked off, I think. But just the terror, or the fear of being caught speaking to a foreigner. And that guy had he probably didn't even know that we were foreigners either. I mean, you know, so that stuck out in my mind. Then when I was in Bucharest, I had a small movie camera with me, and I was taking a film of a people. There was a long line of people, with small petrol containers lined up just to get like, you know, maybe a gallon of gas or kerosene or whatever. And I was filming that. All of a sudden I feel a grip on my arm. And he's a guy in plain clothes. He pulls out a wallet, and I see the word, you know, whatever it was in Romanian. I could say it was the Romanian word for police, police A or something like that. And he was a secret police. And he gestured, "Come with me," you know. And he took me into a police station, and I was interrogated. It was really funny because, of course, I didn't speak a word of Romanian, and they didn't speak any English. And we went before the guy who was in charge, the police chief, and he told me to open up the camera. I didn't want to do that because I didn't want to expose my film. And then I remember he just yells, "Film! Film!" So I wasn't about to argue with him. So, you know, I opened up the compartment, and I remember he twirled the reel around with his finger. You know, it was funny. When I got back home, the film wasn't exposed, but it was a few seconds of a blank space there. I remember seeing that. So, and then he managed to get across to us that you can't, whatever the word was, train or railroad, no filming of that, no aeroporto, whatever the word was, but market, okay, this and that, you know, okay. So he was okay about it. I mean, and he let us go. But it was a little scary. I didn't know what was going to happen to me. But just the creepiness of having a guy come up to you in plain clothes, you know, pulling out a badge and saying, "Come with me." And it was very, very strange. And then I remember also in Bucharest seeing there was two women waiting for a bus. I was directly across the street. And I think that they were walking down the sidewalk. And I saw two men in plain clothes just swoop down on them and take them onto a bus that had stopped across the street, you know, a regular normal bus stop. And it was like, oh man, they're just pulling people off the street. What the hell is that all about? Yeah, so that was a real experience.
They literally like got snatched off the street.
Yeah,
like,
they
right
got snatched off the street. Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah. So you know, you just, you know, after that encounter with that plainclothes guy, I said, you know, I'm just going to behave myself, do nothing even remotely suspicious, you know. But I really like.
Oh, go ahead. I was just going to ask, what was, like, Bucharest is like an old, I mean, it's the capital of the country. It's an old city. What was it like, you think?
Well, it was a big modern city. Nothing really stuck. A lot of people walking around.
I remember reading about it. It's been known as like the Paris of the East. It's like,
I don't know about that. Nah,
yeah.
Well,
it was nothing,
at least the parts I, it was nothing like, Budapest is a beautiful city. And Prague is an absolutely, in Czechoslovakia, which we're not going to have time to talk about. Absolutely beautiful city. Bucharest, didn't really strike me that way. So then we went on, just to finish up, we went to from Romania. Nothing else happened to us bad. I remember we ran into a woman in that beautiful old medieval town called Sigisoara, and she brought us to and then for whatever reason, she wasn't afraid to be with us. She took us to this old medieval church that had a clock that had been running like since the 14th century or something like that. And she took us up, and the guy was showing us the mechanism. It was really, really nice. Very, very sweet people. You know, sometimes it seems the more repressive a country is, the nicer people are, you know. That was certainly my experience in North Korea, too. So then we went to Bulgaria. From there, we went to Bulgaria. And what I remember about Bulgaria, it was just, again, it was very somber, but not as paranoid as in Romania. What I remember about Bulgaria was every little thing you wanted to do, you had to go. If you wanted to eat in a restaurant, you had to go to the tourist office and buy a voucher. You know, if you want to take a bus ride, there was one tourist thing. It's a very famous place called the Rila Monastery, very beautiful monastery. Everything you wanted to do, you had to go to the government tourist office and buy a voucher. You just could. It was very strange. It was a really pain in the neck.
Like, know, everything is like super regulated. Like, you gotta.
It's super regulated. Yeah,
that's crazy.
It was crazy. Then I remember we stayed in with a woman in Sofia, and which is the capital of Bulgaria. And she had a little place out in the country, and she drove us. She had a little old Russian-made car, and she just took us to her little. She had a little bungalow out in the country, and she took us out there. She had her own garden, very simple life, and even though she didn't speak any English, and of course we didn't speak Bulgarian. You know, somehow you can communicate, you know. So that was a very pleasant experience. And that was that was it for that trip as far as seeing communist countries. So it was very educational. And what the neat, you know, as I said earlier, very, very, very few people ventured into these countries. Even, as I said, Romania was a very easy country to get around. And Yugoslavia as well. But it was nice in a way. I mean, you had no big crowds like at the Rila Monastery and other interesting places that we saw. Nobody's in that beautiful little medieval town. You know, nobody from out of the country was there. So,
that's cool. I would like, it would be interesting for you to go back and like compare it now that, you know, it's no longer, you know, a communist regime and, you know, things mm-hmm. have sort of opened up a little bit. I'd imagine it's probably a little bit more developed, a little bit more vibrant and lively, but, you know, who knows? I do know I don't know if you follow – well, actually, I don't even think he's really doing anything online anymore. A guy named Jason Kessler, he took a trip to Eastern Europe, and he, you know, did a few videos about it. Just – I want to say just this past summer, or maybe – when was it? It was recently, like within the past 6 months or so. So I guess it would have been like in the fall or in the winter. And he went to, I think he said he went to Hungary, Prague, Romania, kind of like these Eastern European countries. And it sounded really, really impressive. Like, you know, he made it seem like it was a really cool place.
Well, you know, the difference, first of all, I don't think they've had any third world invasions as far as I know.
At least not to the extent you see in the West. Yeah.
I don't think they would allow it. I mean, I just don't. So it's more genuinely European that way. You know, it's not being destroyed by these, you know, by these people from Africa and Asia, Pakistan. I mean, that it's just not happening over there, as far as I know. But well, actually, I think that guy Orban, the leader of Hungary, he has come right out and said something along those lines. He said this country, Hungary, is going to remain European. So yeah, I don't think they allow it over there. And of course, they don't have. It's, I would imagine it's still not as well to do as the Western European countries. I mean, so there's not there aren't as many goodies waiting for them. Let's put it that way, you know. So and I don't think these invaders are interested in going to these countries in the first place, because they just know that they're not going to be. There's going to be more opposition to them, I imagine.
Well, so, and not only that, but if they make it to France or to Germany or to London, you know, the government will literally give them, like, welfare, put them up in, you know, hotels and
right.
treat them like, you know, first class citizens or something. It's totally ridiculous. Did you go to – I was going to ask, did you go to Ukraine?
Yeah, well, I went to Ukraine in 2000. That was the last foreign trip I took. This is 2018, 5 years ago. The only reason I went to Ukraine was because on that trip, I went to Azerbaijan and Georgia. In Georgia, I went with a tour group, but at Ukraine, I went alone, and I traveled around Azerbaijan alone. But the only reason I went there was because Ukrainian Airlines had, like, the cheapest fare. So it was, like, New York to Kiev, then Kiev to Baku, which is the capital of Azerbaijan, then in Georgia, I flew from Tbilisi back into through Kiev to New York. So it was a very, very reasonable fare. But I only stayed. I didn't travel. I wanted to see a little. You know, Ukraine is very large. It's a huge country. And when I stayed 4 days in Kiev, and I really couldn't get a handle on the place. And I wanted to do some like day trips out into the countryside, but there was like no tourists. They did have trips to Chernobyl, you know, it had the big nuclear accident back in 1985. But I think that was an overnight trip, and it was just too. I really didn't want to do that. I was interested, basically, in just going around the countryside. But they had no tourist infrastructure, and I didn't really understand. I knew a little bit about what happened in 2014, and I did like two walking trips with some. Of the way it works these days, you just bump into these people. They have free walking trips. Then you just tip them at the end. And I asked a lot of questions, but I just couldn't really understand, like, the relation, what was going on between them and Russia and what happened, what was going on in Ukraine now. You know, I'll tell you a very funny thing about that flight, leaving New York, was that it was completely, this is in early September. There were so many Orthodox Jews on that flight. They pretty much, and it was almost completely booked out. The plane, I think, was only about 7 or 8 empty seats. And there were only about 7 or 8, maybe 9 or 10 people like me that weren't Jewish, but all kinds of Orthodox Jews, you know, with the black garb and yarmulkes, everything, were on that flight. And before that we left New York, they had a big mural on the wall, and they were all like bowing to it. It was really weird. What do they call it? There's a word for that, davening or something. They just, like they do before the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, they just go up and down. Have you seen that? You must have seen that.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. I don't know what it's called, but strange. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
And they were doing that in the airport in New York, you know, while we're waiting for the flight. It was really weird. And I was so curious. I went up to one guy. He was like dressed in normal clothes, and I was just curious. I said, can I ask you why, you know, and I said, I was very polite, why there's so many Jewish people on this flight. It's kind of interesting. So he told me that it was something to honor some famous rabbi.
I was going to say, there's some rabbi, some like Orthodox rabbi.
They worship this guy. I don't think it's Schneerson. I don't think it's the Lubavitch guy. I don't know. I don't remember. But I think it's his birthday or something. He's dead now. But they all go there to honor him. So it was just very interesting because, as we know, and as most people don't know, what's going on in Ukraine now is very Jewish. Not only Zelensky is a Jew, but you know, even in Russia too. I mean, there is just so much Jewish influence over this war and what's going on. So I thought it was very interesting that so many Jews would be visiting Ukraine. This one flight completely filled with them. Coming back from Kiev to New York, it wasn't like that. But anyway, that's one memory. So, but I
you know what? It actually might be Sneerson that is.
Maybe it is. Maybe it is.
Yeah, I'm looking at his Wikipedia page. It is definitely some big time Orthodox rabbi that's like buried there or.
Yeah.
Anyways.
And I think it happens the same time every year, early September. So maybe it is his birthday. Maybe So.
That's interesting. Or maybe his death or something. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I jotted down all these other places that I visited. I wanted to talk about China and Vietnam, but we're not going to have time. So,
keep your notes because we can kind of pick up just keep going. Yeah. Next time. I know it's been when was the last time you were on? It's probably at least a month ago.
Yeah. Something like that.
But yeah, no,
maybe
we'll definitely do this again.
If I have a few minutes, I'll just mention also, I went to Albania, which is right there in the Balkans too. Now back then, Albania was like the North Korea of Europe. It was extremely repressive. And if you were an American, there was like no way in the world you could go there. Yeah, I was very close. I was in Yugoslavia, you know, very close to the Albanian border. When I was in Greece, I was close. And then the longtime dictator there, his name was, if I'm pronouncing it right, Enver Hoxha, Hoxha. He died, I think, something like 1989. Then they completely changed their policy. And they let Americans in for the first time. And it could only go with a group. And I believe I might have been in the very first group of Americans that went to Albania. This, I believe, it was in 1990. And that was a very, like North Korea, there was very few cars on the road. The one thing and it was a very interesting experience. You know, they were just opening up to the outside world. You know, at the time, there were some Europeans I think most Europeans were allowed to go there on organized tours. But not many people went there. So it always had this air of real mystery about it, you know, just in the heart of the Balkans, this one country that, you know, very few people visited. I remember one thing that they had these concrete igloos. They were like bunkers in case they were attacked by any foreign country. It was very strange. I've never seen anything like that anywhere else in the world. And they were just like little shelters, and they were all over the city in Tirana. And the weird thing was I went and I looked at a few, and I discovered that people used them as public toilets.
So oh.
They didn't smell very good. So it was very strange.
Yeah, watch
very
out.
Very strange. But that was that was 1990. And but again, they were just like breaking out of communism and opening up to the world. And I don't know. Do we have time? I could talk about the following year. I went to Poland and Czechoslovaia.
Yeah, go ahead, and then we'll wrap up after that. Go ahead.
All right. I went to Poland in 91. I went to Auschwitz. I could talk about my trip to Auschwitz. I went. First I went to Warsaw. Warsaw had been totally destroyed in the Second World War, as most people know. It was very sterile, very uninteresting. I found it the least interesting capital city in Europe. But there were some nice. I went to a town called Krakow, which is where I took the train to Auschwitz. There was a border town, I think, with Czechoslovakia, called Zakopane, very beautiful little town. And you know, just to quickly talk about Auschwitz, when I went there, at this point I knew the Holocaust was a hoax, but I just wanted to see the place with my own eyes too. And the funny thing was, I was on the train, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, maybe I'm going to see things that I'm going to see something there that. That's going to convince me that there really were gas chambers here and everything, you know. And I was like a little bit psychologically, I was uncertain. I didn't know how I would react to the place. And when I got there, I was just on my own, just walking around. It was the most ridiculous. Anybody who couldn't see through this nonsense, which is most people, it was just all they had was like atrocity. They had like piles of shoes and these big. They were like little. Partitions, you know, behind glass of shoes and eyeglasses and suitcases. And the funny thing was, it wasn't really the theme of the place wasn't even really that Jewish. It was more, I think it was more geared to Polish people visiting it and to be brainwashed about what the Nazis, well, maybe they did some bad things, I don't know. But it was more about the Polish prisoners that were, the Polish people that were kept prisoner there. It did not really even have that strong a Jewish theme, which really struck me. And then I just tagged on. There was a British tour group, and I just, you know, they were being guided around, so I just kind of tagged along on the edge of that and listening to the tour guide. And they took us through what was supposed to be the gas chamber. And they were very vague about it. The guide was very vague about that. They didn't get into it. And it was just a big, you've probably seen pictures of it. It's like a, just a big, musty, dark room. You've seen a picture of that, right?
Yeah.
With a light bulb overhead. And then there's like some kind of metal contraption that's supposed to be like the crematorium. But again, they didn't really go into detail. Then, of course, later I found out that the Poles actually built this place in 1948, like 3 years after the, you must know that, right? The whole gas chamber was built after the war, right?
Yeah. Refabricated it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they just built it up from the ground pretty much. So, so it was, and then when I left that place, I said, this is it. I said, I don't know how anybody can't like start asking questions about the basic questions about, you know, how this, like, what does this prove? Like piles of shoes, piles of eyeglasses.
Right.
They had some hands.
Well, that's all it is. It's just like, it's just a psyop. It's just, props.
David Irving called it a Disneyland atrocity, something like that. A Disneyland of atrocities. It was just nonsense. So, but I like Poland. The Polish people were very nice. It was very cheap. And then I'm looking at the map. I remember I must have gone, let me see. I must have gone from Poland. Yeah, I don't remember if I went to, look at the Czechoslovakia. Yeah, I must have gone to Czechoslovakia from there. And like I said earlier, Prague was a very beautiful city. And we had a good time there. And it was very, I should also remark, too, I mean, I don't, well, these Eastern European countries, I mean, I'm getting into food again. The food there was really better, a whole lot better than it was in Russia. So, take that for what it's worth. I remember the food was good. We ate at some nice places in Poland. I did. I was on my own then. And in Czechoslovakia, same thing. There were nice restaurants. And Prague was a very beautiful city. And so that's all I can say. I think we're running out of time, right?
Yeah. I got to run here. But no, we'll definitely do this again. So keep your notes, and we can pick up and talk about. I mean, I'd like to talk about Turkey. I'd like to talk about your travels in the Middle East.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, you've been all over. We haven't even talked about South America, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we got plenty
of
other.
Yeah. If you
want
to talk more about communism, I really would like to talk about Vietnam, because that was a very interesting experience.
Yeah, for sure.
And going through China, they call these places, we'll get into this another time, but Vietnam, to me, it was basically a free country. I can't even see how you would call it communist, and I was there in 2013. And China, I mean, it was much more it was more restrictive, but the people did have their share of free enterprise. It wasn't as repressive as I thought it was going to be, although China is really kind of a separate subject. There's a lot of...
Yeah.
Things you can cover as far as that goes. So,
okay, cool.
All right, John.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what. We'll schedule something in the next few weeks. And in the meantime, keep up the good work. I'll have links over to your website and to your book. And again, yeah, if people out there listening, if you've not picked up Will Vaccines Be the End of Us, definitely do so. It is the final word on the vaccine issue, in my opinion, anyway. So pick up a copy of the book and share it with your friends.
Okay, yeah. Yes, and it's on my site as well. So, all right, John.
Okay.
It was very enjoyable, and we'll hook up again and talk some more about these exotic countries.
Okay, sounds good, buddy.
I always love talking travel. Okay.
All right. Have a good weekend.
Okay. You too.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.